Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents A Visitor's Guide to Georgian England by Monica Hall. Narrated by Anne Flossneck. Chapter 1. How to Be a Georgian. Since H.G. Wells wrote The Time Machine in 1895, people have dreamt of time travelling, no matter that modern science raises some very trenchant objections to its possibility. It captures the modern imagination, rather as heaven did for our ancestors. Who has not daydreamed about, say, nipping back to Tudor times to inform Henry VIII that it is the father who determines the gender of the baby? He wouldn't listen, of course, and one would probably need a way of escaping back to the 21st century instantly to avoid the tower, but that is not the point. Equally fascinating, and very problematic to the more thoughtful would-be time traveller, are the consequences of interfering with history, as encapsulated by Zemeckis and Gale's 1985 film Back to the Future. To do so might preclude the possibility of one's own birth, which would be the ultimate own goal. I personally would like to spend some time among the Georgians. It seems to have been an era of considerable energy and optimism, combining scientific and philosophical progress with the sort of rather unruly social behaviour that we can only wistfully dream about today. We might not actually want to witness a public execution, as they evidently did, but who has not secretly wanted to throw rotting fruit or vegetables at the sanctimonious people in public life who tell you what you should think or how you should live? If you were a Georgian, you would have thrown it, had you the opportunity, forcefully. Above all, the Georgians were optimistic risk-takers. They had to be, as there was no other way to live. They often did dangerous work in which the risk of tetanus or sepsis from wounds was ever present. The Industrial Revolution was underway, bringing both investment and employment opportunities and the risk of losing money. Sanitation and drinking water was dubious, to say the least, especially in towns and cities, and medical help was equally haphazard. Childbirth was still both inevitable and dangerous. But, most importantly, the empire builders were on the move. As a nation, they were not faint-hearted. Those working for the East India Company faced a long and arduous journey in what we would consider ridiculously small and insanitary sailing ships, and when they got there, they had to uphold the white man's burden by enduring tropical weather, parasites and diseases, while persisting with absurdly unsuitable European clothing. Their womenfolk had to struggle to remain British household mistresses while contending with unfamiliar food, ailing children, inscrutable servants, and termites and mould attacking their homes. And they did, even though they had to face the deadly trinity of smallpox, cholera, and plague. And the fact that they died at twice the rate of fellow civil servants in England. Unfortunate soldiers in the East India Company's private armies died like flies. The Georgians, however, had a sense of opportunity and adventure that has evaporated since the vicissitudes of the 20th century. Today, one often feels that life in the West is a competition to see who can live the longest if one obsesses about diet, exercise, and a somewhat depressing level of self-denial, although nobody has yet convinced most of us that staggering into our late 90s is such a very good idea. The Georgians, who did not enjoy our life expectancy anyway, would have thought this a daft objective. Far better, they seem to have thought, to live hard and well in whatever time was available to them. Besides, the established religions that they were slowly coming to doubt did, at least, offer some redemption on their deathbeds. One real difference between the Georgians and their Stuart and Tudor ancestors, however, was the rationality of Enlightenment learning and thinking. 18th-century men and women really did pay considerable attention to the gaps in their traditional knowledge and the scientific discoveries and philosophical thoughts emerging during their era. Largely, they seem to have valued both thought and experience over superstition and undemocratic authority. This makes them modern indeed. In between such highbrow thoughts, however, they liked to have fun, and this is their most endearing quality. In order to understand the Georgians, it is absolutely necessary to anchor their era in the context of what both went before and came after them. We can only but try to feel and understand the life and expectations of the 18th century. For the adventurous time traveller, this book tries to offer an insight into their lives. They had great opportunities as well as considerable difficulties, and they obviously decided that the former should overcome the latter. Anyone wanting to visit Georgian Britain might be rather surprised to find it relatively easy to fit in, because the Georgians, or at least those living in the cities, were rather familiar in their outlook and interests. Such an experience would depend, of course, on whether one were a man or a woman, and whether one were going to attempt to bluff it out in high society or virtuously empathise with life among the rural poor. Like most societies, the Georgians believed in equal opportunities for ordinary women when it came to doing the work, and, although only men could do the heaviest jobs, the average woman would have had to be a lot tougher and physically stronger than most of us. At the beginning of the 18th century, most people were working the land without the benefit of machinery or power. By the end of the 18th century, all this was in the throes of radical change. But during the 18th century, the majority of the population was still mostly illiterate, somewhat superstitious, and beholden to employers or landlords. They were also subject to childhood diseases and infections like tetanus and tuberculosis. Their diet, however, was not so very bad, especially compared to that of the poorer and more numerous and urban Victorians. It was probably neither as tasty nor exciting as ours, but more useful in terms of basic nutrition than we would generally suppose. A nourishing breakfast was often eschewed in humble households due to practical reasons concerning dawn and the demands of livestock, but an early midday meal and a substantial supper were both absolutely necessary. The greatest responsibility of women was to ensure that the workers were well fed. Physically hard-working men needed at least 4,000 plus calories a day, compared to our less than 3,000. Many of these calories were absorbed through bread prepared in the local bakery, which has always been the human staple, together with rice in the Far East. Our ancestors knew the value of carbohydrates. Despite their lack of education, however, some Georgians did display rather modern attitudes. Although outwardly religious, many were extremely suspicious of the relationship between the established Church of England and apparently heedless civil authority. The litany of organised dissenters from the 17th century Reformation onwards is extraordinary. There were the Anabaptists, Baymanists, Diggers and Levellers, Grindletonians, Muggletonians, Ranters, Seekers, and many others. By Georgian times in England, however, it mainly came down to Methodists, Quakers, Baptists, and Unitarians, who were known as rational dissenters. They distrusted the established church with its ritual and litany, were still religious, but believed that embracing the emerging knowledge of natural philosophy, science, might somehow endorse both their modern instincts and traditional beliefs. These were people who could perhaps still recall times when their ancestors were horribly put to death for dissenting or pursuing knowledge. Many of them were relatively poor, brave, and thinking people who just knew that something was not quite fair when it came to their own relationship with religious worship and civil authority. To understand just how these Georgians shaped our modern world and attitudes, however, it would probably be best to land the time machine in London, among the better off. Those who largely held the most power, cultural, intellectual, political, and financial. There were, during the late 18th century, only about 5.5 million people in England and Wales, and maybe another 1 million in Scotland. Remarkably, this population is also configured, but even rather less, in modern New Zealand. There were about 600,000 people in London in 1714, which is about the size of modern Sheffield. This is vastly smaller than now, but nonetheless quite impressive, for 250 years ago, when the whole of London town was barely larger than 3 square miles. However, by 1840, the environs of the capital would have expanded to accommodate nearly 2 million citizens. The decades between the death of Queen Anne, 1714, and 1830 encompassed much of the Enlightenment and were times of great industrial, political, scientific, social, and philosophical development, all of which fueled the growth of the British Empire. This, in turn, led to the rise of Britain as the world leader in Victorian times. Apologists for the Empire often refer to the dastardly English, but this is quite wrong, as any historically aware Scotsman, Irishman, or Welshman could tell you. They were all in it together, especially the Scots, for better and not for worse. Dr. Samuel Johnson, who detested the Scots, despite claiming to have spent a lifetime trying to like them, famously remarked that the noblest prospect which a Scotsman ever sees is the high road that leads him to England. It is interesting that few of the many eminent 18th-century Scots seem to have disagreed with him, at least in practical, if not in cultural, terms. It is impossible to isolate any main driver of Britain's 18th-century development because each contributed to a positive feedback loop, which enhanced progress in other areas. Philosophy, during the Enlightenment, encouraged free thinking, reduced dependence upon the church for answers to difficult questions, and invigorated both science and the arts. Industrial and mechanical advances, mathematics and chemical discoveries fostered the development of natural philosophy as an experimental discipline and made possible the adoption of careful data analysis as a source of hypothesis, experimentation, and progress. Prior to that, the arrival on the throne of a reluctant non-English-speaking Hanoverian in the shape of George I must have made the ascendance of the House of Commons and democracy rather easier. The media was also changing rapidly. Though still only the preserve of the literate, improved technology spread ideas, and worse, irreverence towards the ruling classes. The modern cartoon was born in the 18th century, as was satire, and, suddenly, the great and the good had to beware of ridicule, much to the probable delight of the nation. It was a perfect storm, and one which we should recognize, since we are in the midst of an internet-driven information revolution which bears many philosophical and practical similarities. The Georgians undoubtedly enjoyed their liberty in a freer social culture, but they had not anticipated the industrial change that would be brought about by the progress of science and mechanization in their lifetime. In the 18th century, everything began to change considerably. This is a situation that we should understand. The replacement of less efficient human labor by mechanization, or, in our case now, robotics or artificial intelligence. Human redundancy is a fearful consequence for most people. The time traveler will find many similarities between the Georgians and us, but modern democracy, social sensitivity, and risk assessment are not among them. This may partly be because the Georgians were not enfranchised. Only about 200,000 men were rich and influential enough to have the vote, and many MPs represented rotten boroughs, in which only a handful of men had a disproportionate representation in Parliament. None of this was lost on ordinary people, nor among the media commentators, who wrote and drew for the ever-growing market of political pamphlets, books, newspapers, and ballads. Most working people might not have been able to read very well, or indeed at all, but they did love a cartoon and a song. The powerful had to put up with being bullied, ridiculed, and unmercifully satirized in print, and reputations could both rise and fall very rapidly. One contemporary aspect of all this, with which we would instantly empathize, is the gradual drain of entitlement and self-confidence among those accustomed to rule. Their natural authority was beginning to ebb away. In previous centuries, such impudence might have had very dire consequences, but the Enlightenment and increased literacy was working its magic. There was still an astonishing number of crimes for which the death penalty was available, even though it was carried out far less frequently than we suppose, but being disrespectful to one's betters was no longer one of them. In fact, being merely disrespected was the least of the problems that royalty, the government, and the great and the good had to face. They had to put up with scurrilous and irrefutable slander and libel, against which any legal remedy was feeble, to say the very least. A 21st-century time-traveller might find this rather invigorating, at least for a while, given that we are circumscribed almost to the point of muteness. The Georgians would be very scornful of such a notion, as they were breathing the heady air of freedom of speech, if not the equality and protection of citizens, which we now take for granted, theoretically, at least. They were among the forerunners of modern justice and equality, even though they might not have quite realized that potential in themselves. They were the first to successfully exploit the media as a vehicle for promoting social and governmental change. When not fretting or scoffing about their betters and rulers, however, Britons knew that their country really was a land of unfettered opportunity, one aspect of which is reflected in the amount of building in London in both the public and private sectors. Richard Blome's map of 1673 shows a large town in which London's West End is just beginning to be developed, but it is chiefly distinguished by the amount of arable or swampy land very close by, especially south of the river. John Roke's famous 24-sheet map of 1746 shows the development over 70-odd years. This development was not, of course, mere haphazard expansion. It also involved the considerable redevelopment of existing medieval areas, drainage, the building of the many Georgian terraces that we now so cherish, and great public works. One enthusiast was the neoclassicist and somewhat eccentric architect Sir John Soane, 1753-1837, whose museum in Lincoln's Inn Fields is one of London's hidden gems. His extant, though sometimes remodelled, works include the Bank of England, the Royal Chelsea Hospital, the Dulwich Picture Gallery, and the Freemasons' Hall. It is true that much of the building took place in the Regency era, but it all began some time before that. Before 20th-21st-century gentrification, many Georgian terraces had descended from middle-class aspiration to Victorian slums, due to the huge influx of the poor into London, in search of work and betterment after 1830. Such buildings began, however, as residences for the burgeoning Georgian middle classes. Here again, one finds many similarities with the 21st century. Georgian terraces were often rather jerry-built, as gentrification has laid bare, and many people did comparatively little cooking, being very fond of fast-food takeaway meals. It all sounds strangely familiar. Of course, for any time traveller from the 21st century, the most ghastly consequences will probably be physical. Health, hygiene, and childbirth. It was, naturally, entirely expected that the poor would succumb to such horrors on a regular basis, so it is useful to linger among the better off and discover how they began to improve matters, eventually for all of us. Many discoveries of the 18th century were in fact known to others, but due to poor communications, they had to wait upon later European scholarship for general renown and development. The Turks, for example, had been inoculating their children against smallpox for some considerable time before Edward Jenner, 1749 to 1823, used live virus and a needle, and with considerable success and far fewer deaths. How very lucky for us that it happened in 1796, and that we do not have to face up to such medical ethical dilemmas as trying out one's theories on a small boy, or even oneself. In fact, much of what we now know, understand, and pursue to our own advantage is the direct descendant of unregulated and unethical 18th to mid-20th century science. If I were to advocate a modern phrase to guide you as you pass some time among your Georgian forebears, it would be go for it. They would have both understood and liked that. So, let's go Georgian and shed some preconceptions about our own scientific progress and knowledge. After all, it is only about 65 years since the radio space traveller hero Buck Rogers memorably bawled at his crew to throw some more uranium on the boiler, and that was post-Second World War. We need to take a journey through the lives of the Georgian movers and shakers and the ordinary people, their aspirations, their family, social, working, and political networks, how science and technology changed their lives and hopes, and, of course, how they had fun. First, however, you must be suitably dressed if you hope to deceive anyone into leaving you alone to venture forth from your lodgings and prowl around to find out exactly what Georgian England was like. Chapter 2. Clothes and Beauty.
Clothes make the man. Naked people have little or no influence on society.
Mark Twain, 1835-1910. The first requirement for the time traveller is to blend into the background, and that will mean looking the part. So a visit to Angels, the legendary London theatrical costumiers, might be necessary before departure. With their help, you could hope to pass muster as either an aristocrat or a pauper, although you would undoubtedly smell far too clean, for a while, at any rate. Apart from, perhaps, thongs and killer heels, those of us in the 21st century are accustomed to thinking that our clothes should be reasonably comfortable. This will not be the case in fashionable Georgian circles, when clothes and beauty, for both sexes, involved both discomfort and inconvenience. This did not go unnoticed at the time, with jeering cartoonists lampooning the ultra-fashionable young macaronis, more about whom later. Everyone else got away with being far less ridiculous, of course, but there was no doubt that appearance was very important among the fashionable and aspiring. As indeed it still is today, but undoubtedly less restricting or even dangerous. Il faut souffrir pour être belle is an aphorism which spread here from 18th century France, but was also widely observed in much earlier societies, and means one must suffer for beauty. They certainly did, as had many others before them and since. The Georgians, given their capacity for risk-taking and sheer expenditure in the pursuit of physical attraction, would have been queuing up for Botox, plastic surgery, implants, veneers, hair extensions, and gym membership, had it been possible. As it is, they did their best to subvert the unfairness of time and nature with their own versions of our beauty interventions, and probably just admired each other's efforts rather more than the actual results. Given that, in the 18th century, it was rather easier for the aspiring to dress the part, rather than radically change one's physical attributes, clothes will be considered first. Georgian-era clothes changed very considerably over the years between the accession of George I, 1714, to the death of George IV, 1830.
The immediate precursor was the Baroque period, which is defined as dating from about 1650 and embraced not only changes in the design of clothes, but also in architecture, art, and music. Baroque fashion in Europe was most influenced by the royal family and wealthy courtiers at the court of the Sun King, Louis XIV, 1638 to 1715, at Versailles. The reputation of Parisian couturiers, which endures to this day, was well and truly established after Louis certified the establishment of a guild of dressmakers, embracing both men and women designers, who must rank among the earliest and canniest of modern marketers. These people understood the importance of ever-changing designs for their richest clients, the trickle-down effects of the bourgeoisie aping their betters, and the financial opportunities as the former tried to play catch-up, whilst the rich were determined to deny lesser and scorned mortals any such chance. They established the principles of market segmentation, differential pricing policy, and built-in product obsolescence, and they skillfully exploited it. To understand exactly how canny were these clothes designers, it is necessary to take a closer look at both the clothes designs they inherited and the legacy they left the Georgians. Charles II, 1630 to 1685, the Merry Monarch, was a very keen consumer of extravagant Baroque clothing, as befits his reputation as a ladies' man. He had, of course, been brought up in fashionable Europe after the age of 14, when he fought alongside his father, and was then obliged to flee. His father, Charles I, was executed by the parliamentarians in 1649, and was usually painted wearing a 17th-century-style Picardel ruff. After the Restoration, Charles II favoured big wigs, ruffles, tricorn hats, and extravagantly embroidered but coordinated coats and breeches. This was the genesis of the modern suit, known to the French in the 18th century as the suite. It is interesting to note here that the women's Baroque clothing was not designed to encourage rapid movement, or indeed anything beyond being sedately decorative. The gentlemen, on the other hand, were free to stride around, even if somewhat encumbered by swords and wigs. One of the most distinctive aspects was the display of the gentleman's calf in tights below knee breeches. This appears to have been both alluring to women and a symbol of powerful masculinity to other men, and endured until the demise of breeches in favour of trousers in the 19th century. This was true only if you had a good calf, of course. A man with a weedy calf must have suffered considerably in terms of self-esteem. This was not new, of course, as anyone familiar with the portraits of Henry VIII and his son, Edward VI, in their power poses, will know. The key to masculine approval until the late 18th century was muscularity, which led to some rather strange depictions of obviously obese, rakish, or elderly gentlemen who were still apparently sporting a relatively comely calf, as can be seen in cartoons of the Prince Regent, as drawn by Gilray, for example. George IV's physical shortcomings, including his congested facial complexion and drunken eyes, received no mercy at all, except for his calf muscles, even if they have to be sufficiently stout to support all that dissolute fat. Rumour had it, though, that George bulked out his calves with prosthetics for public appearances, so iconic were a man's lower legs. There were cartoons in which a victim's pitiful calf was exaggerated to add to the satirical effect. Gilray drew a very weedy Prime Minister, William Pitt the Younger, bursting in to break bad news about the Swedish royal family to King George III and Queen Charlotte, neither of whom are kindly depicted on their shared commode, both looking irredeemably stupid and nothing like monarchs. The imputation was that the shooting of the Swedish king was a much better laxative for the constipated king than any medicine could be. Baroque clothes left a clear legacy for both the Georgians, the Victorians, and us, as the gentleman's suit gradually began to evolve. Beginning as a fashion extravaganza in the Baroque period, the suite became a statement of power and authority as it became more stylized and less...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?